Giles Brown.
Let's talk.
White supremacy. Gavin Evans traces the historical roots of a white supremacy beginning in the 19th century with Charles Darwin, taking us through the 20th century and what you might argue is a revival. I'm delighted to say that Gavin joins me live on the line now. Gavin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining. Whereabouts are you this morning, by the way?
I'm in North London.
Super. Right. White supremacy. You've taken this back to the historical roots of this, because if you mention white supremacy to a lot of people, they will immediately think Ku Klux Klan, 1930s, the film Birth of a Nation, etc. So, but where do you start with your book?
So I start with Charles Darwin, which might surprise a lot of people, because most people, and appropriately, think of Darwin as not only a great scientist, but also as a humanist, someone who was kind to people individually, who helped individual black people as well, and so on. But he had what today would be considered extraordinarily racist views, which got worse and more extreme in the late 19th century as race science started to kind of kick in the public discourse. So he made a number of statements about black people being inferior intellectually to white people. And he also made a number of statements about that the stock of intelligent humanity needed to be improved. So that's the basis of eugenics. And then his cousin, a guy called Galton, ran with that. He ran with that. And he developed what he called eugenics. About, on the one hand, improving the stock of humanity. He felt that rich people were more intelligent than poor people, as well as white people were more intelligent than black people, and eliminating those who he said were genetically inferior, which included Africans, which included people who were mentally disabled, which included anyone who he thought was not intellectually up to scratch. So that was the basis of eugenics, and it's spread from then on.
It's interesting because, you know, we think of Darwin, we're thinking of the Age of Enlightenment and the great scientific developments that go with that. And can you argue then from an expansionist, imperialist backdrop that Darwin has in terms of, you know, people are exploring, they're calling it the New World, the Dark Continent, the Far East, which of course we don't call those anymore. And it seems that there is unbridled optimism, but at the same time, they need to justify why the British Empire or the French Empire or the German empires are, if you like, subjugating and subduing these other races.
Yeah, I think colonialism does have a lot to do with it. I mean, it's not a coincidence that it was in the era of the great colonial expansion in the second half of the 19th century that race, what became known as race science, I always think of it as scientific racism, but or faux scientific racism, really takes off. And people like Darwin and Galton are part of it. I mean, there was resistance to it. There were people. It's not like there were no other ideas. There were people who were vehemently opposed. The person who also discovered natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace, was vehemently opposed to both racism and to eugenics, and was a feminist throughout his life. So, and there were others as well. So it wasn't as if there were no other ideas around, but those were certainly the dominant ideas, and they became even more dominant in the first half of the 20th century, really until the Nazis were defeated.
Because obviously, Darwin is, if you like, he's talking to the scientific community. He's talking to the founders of empire. He's preaching to the converted. And obviously, as I said before, this is an expansionist time with the empire. And so, if you are a middle-class civil servant, a British Army officer, in a posting in Rhodesia, for example. And by your accent, you come from that part of the, you know, that the, from Southern Africa as well. You know, call me a detective, whatever. But people will think, yes, absolutely. You know, Darwin is right, because look, I'm living, breathing proof that we are superior to other races.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to say to that, because if you are dominating another lot of people, if you're ordering them about, if they having to kowtow to you, if you are using violence against them as was part of the colonial project, and if that colonialism was part of that colonialism, certainly in Britain's West Indies territories, was implicated with slavery, then your attitudes to those you dominate, those you enslave, are not likely to be that they are your equals. That would be an uncomfortable thing for anybody to hold, an uncomfortable idea. So yes, I mean the colonial experience reinforced and deepened that racism in throughout the British and French and American society.
And also, of course, is that there's that natural Christian thing in the order of things. We are in a predisposed order, you know, some to lead, some to follow, etc. And so therefore we are, you know, you are spreading the word of God, and therefore these people are in fear. They don't, you know, they're seen as quote unquote savages, basically.
There was that. I mean, Christianity also often was preceded. Colonialism was preceded by missionaries. So, and the idea that you subjugate a people so that you can bring them to Christ, that kind of thing. I mean, there was also within the South African colonial experiment the Calvinist idea that the descendants of Ham. Ham was one of the sons of Noah who saw his father naked, and that was a really bad thing. So he was, his sons and for forevermore were cursed. And there was a view in the Dutch Reformed Church that those were the black people. And that view also existed in bits and pieces of American slave society as well.
So far, so bad. Let's move on to sort of if we can to the 20s and the 20th century. We have the war to end all wars. Of course, we have various nations from quote unquote empire coming back to fight in Europe. Indians, there are several, and obviously from South Africa and from all around, you know, the empire. But we have this after the empire. We have this Huxley and Brave New World. You know, this is going to be again, science is making huge steps. Eugenics is obviously sounding very, 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 very appealing, because the science thinks it has a cure for everything, and this is the way that the world is supposed to be.
Yes, and part of eugenics was this idea that everything was genetically related. I mean, Galton didn't know about genes and rejected genetics. In the early 20th century, but nevertheless, the people who ran with eugenics were people who sort of thought like Mendel's P experiments, that just one version of a gene could make all the difference. Now we now know better. We now know that doesn't exist. But that was the view behind eugenics, so that if you could improve the stock by eliminating those who had bad genes. So that was seen as a scientific idea, particularly in the United States. And then the eugenics of the United States spread to Nazi Germany, and there was a close link between them that has its residues today.
So, I mean, if you say United States, everybody's immediately thinking Deep South, Alabama, Georgia, many, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, you know, the Jim Crow laws, etc. And that has always seemed to me as a layman as obviously intrinsically wrong, but sort of wired into their DNA by an educated population. Obviously, it's different in New York, and it's different in California or whatever. So who are the scientists for eugenics that take this over, or that goes across the Atlantic to Europe then?
Well, okay, so the scientists, or if you can call them that, were mainly in the north. I mean, they almost entirely in the north, actually, and they were IQ theorists. Now, the whole idea of IQ started in France, and the person who discovered or invented it said, look, it doesn't measure intelligence. It just measures certain kinds of abilities and not intelligence. But once it went to America, people thought it measured innate intelligence, which I think we is simply wrong. Of course, when you test groups, you find that they have different exposure to things like abstract logic, which is what IQ measures. So you had different groups who measured different average IQs. I mean, surprisingly, you might find Ashkenazi Jewish people in that time tested below average on IQs, and the immigration decisions were made on the basis of that. It's one of the reasons why fewer Jews were allowed in, and many Jews were refused entry when they wanted to escape Nazi Germany in the 1930s. So that kind of idea, and then there were close contacts between some of the key people involved in implementing eugenics in the United States, and they forcibly sterilized about 70,000 people. And that spread to Nazi Germany. So there were close links between some of the key thinkers in America and Nazi Germany. And those actually survived during the war as well. America was very, Nazi Germany was very impressed with what the Americans were doing with eugenics. So it was a direct influence, not an indirect one.
Yeah, but if you know European history, there is an inbuilt anti-Semitism in European history, all through European history. Mm. And so they got to do is literally just light the blue touch paper and retire on that with that one, because there's an inbuilt racism. Saying, well, you know, we are Christians, we are Christian Europe, therefore the Jews are quote unquote the other. But also in Germany, or in fascist states, but particularly in Germany in the 30s, science is the way forward, because fascism, and obviously Nazism is fascism on steroids and taken to the most extreme, but scientists are rock stars. Everybody thinks the future is science, be it streamlining, be it aviation, be it, you know, as rockets will start to be developed, etc., during the war. So this is seen as forward thinking. And of course, when you have such a twisted mentality as Nazism, they are going to take that to the extremes, and then there are further experiments that carried out, which go way beyond, which is even way beyond the pale. I think I'll draw a line on that one.
Yes. So, I think you're quite right. There was a view that what they were doing was about, I mean, it was called racial hygiene. And it had a scientific gloss to it. And they believed that what they were doing was scientific. And that in the spirit of science, you had to do things that were hard. And it really, I mean, you go back to the early 19th century, and you see it starting in Germany in a concerted way with what happened in Namibia, where the kind of the first genocide of the 20th century happened in Namibia. The populations of two of the African tribes were almost wiped out as a result of what the Germans did there. And there were experiments on prisoners, often without anesthetic and so on, by the people who later became officials in the 30 years later in the Nazis. So there was this line of faux science that became dominant by the time the Nazis came to power. So eugenics in Germany had already taken root in a deep way when the Nazis came to power. So it wasn't as if they invented it. They just applied it to an extraordinary degree.
And not only that, but they applied it at the same time, but their legislation was also reworked so that you have the race laws coming in, so that certain groups of certain races are discriminated against. You're thinking of, for example, the mixed race children that were being born in Alsace-Lorraine and that period of time because of colonial French soldiers who were in that area in the 20s, and they were having relations with European women, and therefore there were mixed race babies being born, and they had some
forcibly sterilized. Yeah, exactly.
So, we know, obviously, if you know anything of history, how the Second World War comes, the Nazis are wiped off, mainly off the face of the earth. Obviously, some of them go to various places. And that would seem, you would think, to be the end of eugenics and white supremacy. But, you know, we have seen in various places that continue. I mean, as I said before, you were an anti-apartheid activist, of course, so you know only too well what was happening in South Africa during the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And obviously we've seen interesting political ramifications within the past 15 to 20 years.
Yeah, in the past 2 or 3 years as well.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of background there. For about 15, 20 years, eugenics kept its head very low. Although the forcible sterilizations carried on in Sweden, in Denmark, and in the United States. The last forcible sterilization in the United States took place in Portland, Oregon, in 1980. So,
but what was the reason? What was the reason behind those forcible sterilizations, though, in Denmark and Sweden? Because I haven't, because that a lot of people would be raising an eyebrow on that one.
They were considered to be subpar intellectually. People with what we'd call now learning difficulties.
Sure.
Yeah. So that there was that. Sort of bubbling away, because what happened after the war was people thought, okay, it's not genes, it's all society. Whereas we now sort of think that a lot of behavior has some genetic component to it, but society has a huge influence. But what happened in the late 1960s was that there was a group of mainly evolutionary psychologists and educational psychologists who were kind of bubbling away on the race science thing. And they were funded by something called the Pioneer Fund. Now, the Pioneer Fund was set up by an American in 1937 who was in deep collaboration with the Nazis and believed that black people should be segregated, who believed that eugenics was a great thing. And that continued. So that's what the Pioneer Fund is all about. And they were funded by the Pioneer Fund. And they had their kind of house journals, and they were pumping out kind of race science, but no one was noticing them. And then one of their number published a paper which got found its way into the Harvard Review and then was withdrawn later. But suddenly it takes off, and it goes... They become much more active, much more vocal, until you get in the early 1980s, they start putting out more material, and until we get to a book called The Bell Curve. Now, The Bell Curve was a book which claims that the reason that the poor people are innately less intelligent than those who are richer, and that the reason they're more poor black people in America is because they're innately less intelligent. So it's a deeply racist book. Its premises, its conclusions, and its methods have been absolutely excoriated by experts in each of the areas that it looks at. But it became a bestseller, and kind of race science starts to take off after that in the 1990s, and it becomes more mainstream.
Could you argue that the ground is more fertile for those sort of outlandish ideas to take root then, because of the political situation, because of a world economic crisis, because of conspiracy theories and the rise of populism?
Yeah, I think that's a very important part of it. I mean, you're getting on the one hand people feeling left behind, mainly young white men. So the gap in support for Kamala Harris and Trump among young white men and young white women is huge. So they're feeling left behind, and they find their way to these message board sites, which has its own kind of culture of what they call kek, which is fun at other people's expense. And they feel like they've been red-pilled into these ideas of race science. And you find them on places like 4chan, which is a message board site, and 8kun, which is another message board site, and Gab, which is another message board site. And the ideas kind of are fertilized there. And it's in those channels, those message board sites, where all of the alt-right killers, the people who use AK-47s to go and gun down black people or Jewish people or Asian people or Mexican people, the ideas all come from there. And they're pure race science. It goes all the way back to eugenics, the kinds of things that Galton was saying 150 years earlier, almost word for word being repeated there. So that's the one side of it. But there are other more mainstream people who are pushing it. I mean, one of them, and this might surprise people, is the psychologist Steven Pinker. Now, Steven Pinker has advanced the idea that Ashkenazi Jewish people, of which he's one, are innately more intelligent than anybody else. Now, you might think, well, everybody knows that Jewish people are smart. And, you know, my father, my father was Jewish. But it's a bad idea, not only because there's no evidence for that at all. And the paper that he based it on, has been absolutely demolished. If you're going to say one group's more innately more intelligent than another, then you're implicitly saying that other groups are innately less intelligent. So it's the kind of cat's paw for scientific racism. And Pinker has been a big promoter of that. There have been others who the journalist Andrew Sullivan has promoted the bell curve, and Jordan Peterson has also promoted the same idea. So people who've got mainstream reach are kind of helping to legitimize these ideas. And then on the other hand, there's this bubbling subculture on places like 4chan.
It's an interesting situation, isn't it? Because there are disaffected youths everywhere on the internet. And I say this quite a lot on my shows when I do my phone-in shows, is the fact that if you are in a majority group, if you're a white male and you can't understand, and you're a white poor male or a white poor couple, and you can't understand why you're not getting what you need, you're not getting what the Kardashians are getting or something like that, and seeing on social media because you've been bombarded by images, you will think that, you know, the reason is because, you know, you should be entitled to, because you are inherently more intelligent or more privileged than that. And that's why, you know, people like this have social media followings, or will take out in the most horrendous ways their vengeance.
Yep. And it's not, I mean, it's both on race, but it's invariably also relates to women and gay people as well, but most particularly women. I mean, when I was researching the book, and I went into 4chan, and, you know, and I would look at it every day for a week, and then I'd have to give myself a long rest.
Well, this is the incel. This is the incel thing, isn't it? This is the young white male.
It's not only incel, it's the sort of Andrew Tates and people like that. So it's both the incels, who are often very racist, and the kind of extreme misogynists who think that rape is a right and that kind of thing. I mean, you really are getting that kind of thing. And at the same time, they're talking in the same terms about black people. So the racism and the misogyny go together.
Unfortunately, as you can tell, we could probably talk about this for another for 3 or 4 hours, but I'm going to run out of time. If people want to find you online, where is the best place to go, Gavin?
So on Twitter, I'm at GMR Evans. So that's probably a good one to find me.
And you can order the book via our own virtual bookstore as well. The book is called White Supremacy. Gavin Evans, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Giles.